From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. When Betty Jackson was a little girl, she would sneak down the hallway and watch her grandfather through a keyhole. Now, she's the only person alive who remembers Deacon White, a catcher who got the first hit in professional baseball.
He caught the ball with bare hands, and all of his fingers had been broken. The shape of his hand was like the shape of a baseball.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. Also, a tribute to newly minted Hall of Famer Rebecca Lobo. Stay tuned.
Well, what I've got here to read is all the things I remember of Grandpa. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Betty Jackson's memory isn't so good these days. She's 96. She'll turn 97 in December. But she still has 7 memories of her grandfather, James Deacon White. White was a catcher and a baseball pioneer. Back in 1871, 5 decades before Betty was born, White got the first hit in professional baseball.
He was a great grandfather. I loved him very much. And as far as I know, I'm the only one alive that remembers him.
Betty was 5 when White came to live with her family in Mendota, Illinois. Her most vivid memory is sneaking down the hallway to his bedroom on the 2nd floor.
And I would peek through the keyhole in his door, and sometimes he was fixing one of my broken toys. I don't remember him fixing anybody else's toy, but he fixed all of mine.
Betty says she doesn't remember ever seeing her grandfather smile, though a smile would have been difficult to see under his big walrus mustache. But she does remember his fingers, so swollen and bent that he couldn't even hold her hand.
He caught the ball with bare hands, and all of his fingers had been broken, and they were all... The shape of his hand was like the shape of a baseball.
Betty says it was her job to take care of Grandpa.
Whenever he wanted something, he'd knock his cane on the floor and I'd go tearing up. I took care of him for a long time and we were very close. I loved him very much and I think he loved me, although I'm sure he never told me that.
Did he ever get angry or speak harshly to you?
Only when somebody didn't know how to play baseball. There was a bunch of girls that used to play baseball in our yard. And he would sit up on the 2nd floor porch right next to his room. And he would watch us play baseball. One day he pointed to one girl and he said, "You would be an all-star." And then he pointed to me and said, "You figure out something else to do."
And you're laughing now. Were you laughing then?
I laughed then. It didn't bother me at all.
Deacon White learned to play baseball as a teenager in upstate New York.
Baseball started to develop during the Civil War and was played by Civil War soldiers.
This is White's great-grandson, Betty's nephew, Mark Trembeau.
So as the Civil War veterans started coming back, they brought a love of baseball with them. You know, he was just a teenager at that time. And so baseball, I think, was an attractive way to get out and have some fun with the guys.
When he was 23, White found himself with the Cleveland Forest Cities, one of the first baseball teams to be considered professional. Betty doesn't remember anything about White's playing days. Her son, Caddy Jackson, says he learned a lot from a book about 19th century catchers by baseball historian Peter Morris. Here's Caddy.
According to Morris's book, during the 70s, the catcher was not only the most important position, but it was kind of a folk hero. The country was looking for heroes following the Civil War, someone like Daniel Boone who could conquer the wilderness. And then the catcher was able to stand behind the plate and take the physical abuse without a mitt and without a mask.
It was a time where catchers were so valuable defensively that if you were good enough as a catcher, you could literally not hit and still be a valuable player.
That's baseball historian Peter Morris.
Well, Deacon White combined being the best defensive catcher in the game with being one of the best hitters in the game.
Barehanded catchers were prone to injury. Their careers generally didn't last very long at all. But White played the position until he was 31, and then switched to third base and played for another 12 years. He did get the first hit in the first professional baseball game, but that was more of a fluke than anything else. Most historians recognize the National Association as the first professional baseball league, and he had the first at-bat in the league's only opening day that wasn't rained out. He hit for a double. But there was something else that made Deacon White stand out.
By the time he started playing baseball, he was very convinced that these were special times.
That's White's great-grandson, Mark, again. White was a member of the Advent Christian Church, which followed the teachings of William Miller, a former Baptist preacher who believed the second coming of Christ was imminent.
And so Deacon did all he could to become the best Christian he could. And it influenced all aspects of his life, including how he played the game of baseball.
He would not play on Sunday.
Again, this is White's great-grandson, Caddy Jackson.
He would not chew. He would not smoke. He would not drink. He would not cuss. Certainly would not take any performance-enhancing drugs.
So he was serious.
He really was, yeah.
Wow. Wow.
He would be, you know, I suppose some people would call him somewhat fanatical now.
But back in the 1870s, White's teammates had another word to describe him.
Many of these men had just come back from the war, and so they were a rough and tumble group. So James White acquired the name Deacon simply because he took his religion so seriously.
White retired in 1891 after 20 years in the pros. Late in his career, the Detroit Free Press put it like this: no one ever yet heard Deacon White say, "Damn it." No one ever saw him spike or trample upon an opponent. No one ever saw him hurl his bat toward the bench when he struck out. No one ever heard him wish the umpire were where the wicked never cease from troubling and the weary never give us a rest. And think of it, 19 years of provocation. Will anybody deny that Deacon White is a great and good man, as well as a first-class ball player? Betty Jackson never knew her grandfather as a ball player, but she believed him to be a great and good man. And once his playing days were behind him, he focused 100% of his energy on his religion.
He knew that Christ was coming back, and he knew he was coming and while he was alive. And he would sit on the back porch, rocking in his rocking chair, waiting for Jesus. He spent most of his time doing that.
One night, White looked out in the distance and was sure the time had come. He ran back into the house and screamed,
"Jesus is coming! Jesus is coming!" We ran upstairs and some very smart person says, "Oh, that's Aurora Borealis."
Were you terribly disappointed?
Well, I wasn't. I'm sure he was.
The Baseball Hall of Fame inducted its first class in 1936. White was sure he'd be invited. He was wrong. Here's historian Peter Morris.
You know, they were starting from scratch. So the first five were the Babe Ruths and the Ty Cobbs and Christy Mathews and Hannes Wagner. They had just such a backlog of great players. I mean, it took Cy Young a couple times to get in, and he won 511 games.
White had the credentials for a Hall of Fame bid. His importance in developing the role of a catcher was unmatched. Teams played as few as 40 games in those early seasons, but White's 2,000 hits in just 1,500 games would equal about 4,000 hits today. But the voters in the 1930s didn't know any of that. Decent statistics for White's best years hadn't even been compiled yet. And White's last game had been in 1890. Anyone who'd seen him play was now in their 70s, at least.
So he didn't get any real consideration at that time and just fell off the ballot at that point. And he was very disappointed.
White spent his last few years waiting for the call from the Hall of Fame and for Jesus. And then on July 7th, 1939, it was too late.
Oh, he died. Let me stop and think just a half a second here. It was in the morning, and we were at a summer home that we had on the river, about 20 miles from where we lived, and we spent all the summers up there. He had his room there right next to the kitchen. And Mother came out and just said, well, Grandpa is dead. Grandpa died last night. He was fine when he went to bed, but he just died in his sleep. I loved him very, very much. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not sure anybody else loved him as much as I did.
Over the next seven decades, White's grandchildren and great-grandchildren tried to get him into the Hall of Fame, but their pleas never got very far, until 2012.
So in 2012, there was a committee of 16 people, four Hall of Famers, four Major League executives, six sports writers, and two historians.
This pre-integration veterans committee would consider 10 candidates for the class of 2013, including Deacon White. And Peter Morris was one of those two historians. So he made sure the members of the committee understood the math, that Deacon's 2000 hits alone should qualify him for induction. Ann Morris says the committee also discussed White's character. This was the first year of eligibility for Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, who both had been accused of performance-enhancing drug use. The baseball writers would fail to elect a single living player, so character was definitely on the table. But the Veterans Committee was considering at least one candidate whose character was above reproach.
We spent a whole day, you know, just kind of making sure that we all had a really good understanding of the credentials of each of the 10 people. And then we had a secret vote.
And I assume, and maybe because it's secret, you can't tell me this, but I assume that you were one of the people who was planning to vote for White?
Well, yeah, that's something I'm not really supposed to tell you. You can certainly make an assumption like that, but I made a promise not to confirm that. So
12 votes were needed. Deacon White received 13. He was in. His family was shocked. They'd all given up. Betty was asked to speak at the induction ceremony, but she says she didn't feel like she could do it. So in July of 2013, Deacon White's great-grandson, Jerry Watkins, gave the acceptance speech at the Hall of Fame.
In my heart, I never believed this day would come. But you got to remember, Cub fans are really good at waiting.
Betty was there, too, along with almost 50 members of Deacon White's family.
And this is a day we will all remember for the rest of our lives.
When I was saying goodbye to Betty, she thanked me for helping her remember things she thought she had forgotten about her grandfather. And it's true, she managed to remember a lot more than seven things. But this moment, in Cooperstown, with almost 50 members of her family watching as Deacon White was finally welcomed into the Hall of Fame, Betty Jackson remembered this moment all on her own. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank CNM24 for leaving the following review on iTunes. I am not a big sports fan, but a fan of the ethics, drama, competition, and culture they represent and symbolize. Bill and company tell wonderful stories every week about major league sports and small-time sports, and sometimes sports you've never heard of. What they always seem to do is share stories that inspire, inform, and entertain. Subscribe now. Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss a show. And while you're at it, leave us a review. It really does help. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield.
Ripped to right. It's down over. The line. Fair ball. Around third, Ramirez will score. It's a walk-off for number 22.
On Thursday night, the Cleveland Indians won their 22nd straight game, and that's where we're going to start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder and NBC Sports Craig Calcaterra. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Craig, take it away.
As the Indians' winning streak hit into the 20s this past week, there was a debate about whether or not they were going to be able to get the all-time winning streak. And the funny thing about that debate is what the all-time winning streak is. Some have pointed to the 1935 Cubs, who won 21 straight. Others have pointed to the 1916 New York Giants, who once went 26 games without losing. But the problem was, in the middle of that run, they had a tie game. It was suspended due to darkness. Now, there are a lot of arguments, one side or the other, on which record counts, and I'm not going to get into the complicated reasons for each one. But what fascinates me about this is how, once again, baseball lends itself to having a finite event and a finite number lend itself to debate. People can't decide whether 26 or 21 is better, just like they can't decide whether with home runs 73, 62, 61, or 60 is better. It's amazing that baseball does this all the time. We're often accused in my favorite sport of being slaves to statistics, but in reality, statistics are just a starting point for us just to argue about all kinds of emotional things, like how many wins is a winning streak.
I mean, I just think something kind of wonderful about baseball is that curmudgeon-y sort of desire to have everything be factual when there's no thing that is totally factual, right? It's, I mean, it's exactly what Craig was saying. It's like, well, if the tie actually counts, that, you know, it's like a bunch of nerds getting together to argue over something in like the most delightful way. And I think because baseball has such a long history, there's so many opportunities to do that. But I think it also does make breaking records feel a little more significant because it's like, look, this sport has been around for so long, and we just did something new. It carries this emotional weight that goes back generations, which is actually pretty moving, I think.
Well, I do think the history of baseball makes these sorts of records absolutely moving, but I think we're losing out. I mean, you called these debates delightful, but I kind of find them anything but delightful. When I first saw this controversy over, is it 21, is it 26, I was like, this is why people hate baseball. This is why. This is the moment, because no matter how much you know about baseball, there's always some geek who thinks that they know more. And then I thought, this is why so many people hate sports, because it's not just true of baseball. It is true of every sport out there.
I agree with you. I think there's an unpleasant aspect to it. And where I think it really centers on is taking something that should just be a pastime and should just be enjoyable. Hey, no matter how many wins they have in a row, it's cool to watch the Indians win this many games in a row, and try to turn it into some factual black and white qualitative thing. And I think we do that in sports, we do it in politics, we do it everywhere. There's not something that's good or bad. There's not something that's just enjoyable. There's something that's right or wrong. And gosh, that is such a drag.
I think the reason I like it in sports, though, is because none of this matters. Who cares? Like, yes. Like, who cares?
All right. Well, so let's debate something else that doesn't matter. When I first started watching football, one of the first things I noticed was that poor guy who'd get the ball shoved into his hands and then he'd run smack into the other team. And I thought, ouch, why does he do that? And then I learned more about the game and I learned to appreciate the position and the strategy and the athleticism and all the things that make a big play by a running back just super cool. But then this week, I learned through an article by Sports Illustrated writer and friend of Only a Game, Jacob Feldman, that running backs in the NFL, on average, have the third lowest salaries, ahead only of fullbacks and long snappers. Their careers are the second shortest, only 2 years and 5 months. They're placed on injured reserve twice as often as any other position. And yet, this position is still super popular. There's lots of kids who want to play it. And so I'm back to why.
I think the glory of being a running back is pretty significant. Yeah, you get injured more. It's a more dangerous position. But if you're really good at it, the satisfaction, I think, that comes from literally busting through a wall of other people, and it's one against a million, and you get through, and, you know, they win games. So I think in sports, a lot of times it's easy to look at stats or look at injury lists and sort of try to think of it rationally. But I think that an aspect of sports is that there is this incredible desire for glory and something intangible. And I think running backs, I think that's sort of what defines that position.
It's the NFL in microcosm, right? We have a exciting, exhilarating glory position, just like the game itself, when watching it, can be exciting and exhilarating for fans. Yet the person that's doing the work there is just getting completely chewed up and spit out. And for every Zeke Elliott, you've got an Earl Campbell who can't get out of a chair. I grew up watching Billy Sims and Walter Payton play, and I wanted to be a running back. I didn't have the skills, but I wanted to be that because of that glory. And as I've gotten older and as you learn what happens to these guys, you have a hard time watching it, and it's just really sad and causes a dilemma on the part of the viewer, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, I don't have anything to say to that, so I'm just going to move on.
I brought us all down. None of this matters. It's only a game, and then I'm talking about death.
On that happy note, it's baseball season. It's football season. It's also the season for ranking NBA players. Charlotte, please explain.
Yes. Oh, I love this. Well, so journalists are, you know, you need to write about stuff, so we rank stuff. I have ranked underrated foods before. Somehow that was sports. But people who actually know what they're talking about rank NBA players, and ESPN has been slowly releasing their top 100 players, and Carmelo Anthony was less than thrilled to find out that he had been ranked 64th. So he tweeted about this, and then CJ McCollum tweeted that players should rank journalists. And I saw this and I was immediately like, if I am not number one, I did not go to liberal arts school for this. No, there's no way I would be number one. But I did just think it was this really interesting dynamic where social media has presented this new way that athletes and journalists can interact. And it was sort of like breaking that fourth wall.
Every December for about 4 or 5 years now, I've done a ranking of the most handsome baseball managers from 1 to 30.
And you get all the way to 30.
Oh, yeah. I rank them all in detail. And over the last few years, the results of this have started to come back to the managers. And I found out that the ones who are ranking 29 and 30, guys like Clint Hurdle and Bruce Bochy and Mike Socha, they love that they rank low. And the guys who are up high, like Brad Ausmus and Mike Matheny, they bristle and they don't want to talk about it. It's embarrassing for them. So if you're ranking it on that way, then it could be okay. So I welcome them to rank journalists, actually, and I want to be dead last. Because as George Orwell said, journalism is printing what everyone else does not want printed, and everything else is public relations. If athletes love me, I'm not doing my job, he said, with his press hat on and his cigar and all that kind of stuff.
All right, but how exactly would you rank journalists? I mean, the ability to type and eat pizza at the same time. I don't know, the ability to get an athlete to say something other than we're going to give it 110% and good Lord willing.
In baseball, it would be knowledge of the Bruce Springsteen catalog, because that's a cliche of baseball writers.
It would be how many pairs of pleated khakis and New Balance shoes do you own?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it would be unfair because all the baby boomer ones would win, and those of us in Gen X would not do very well in that category.
And us poor millennials would just be not even on the list.
You wouldn't even
You'd
make
be
it.
Ranked on, like, avocado consumption.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Craig Halkatera of NBC Sports and Charlotte Wilder of SB Nation. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks,
Karen.
Last weekend, Rebecca Lobo was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. And if I could listen to her acceptance speech on repeat, I probably would. She told stories about her time at the University of Connecticut and about realizing her dream of going pro in the WNBA. She talked about meeting her husband, Sports Illustrated writer Steve Rushen, and she talked about her kids.
When my oldest daughter was about 5 years old, it was March Madness, so I was on the road calling a basketball game. And my husband was watching the UConn men's team. And my five-year-old came in and looked at the TV, and she said, Daddy, are those boys playing basketball? And he said, yes, they are. And she said, I didn't know boys played basketball, too.
In honor of Rebecca Lobo's Hall of Fame induction, we'd like to give a 2012 Sports Illustrated column written by Steve Rushen a double play. That's what we call our occasional feature that turns sports columns into radio dramas. The column was called Finding a Long-Forgotten Gold Medal and Getting Chills All Over Again.
These are the best athletes in the world.
The announcer was saying over an Olympic event that was blocked by my 7-year-old silhouette, her head, ears, and pigtails backlit by the TV screen. A light bulb buzzed to life above that head, and she said, without turning around,
Mom, you were in the Olympics, right? A long time ago,
my wife said from her armchair.
Still.
our daughter said, checking the math of her own logic.
That means you were one of the best people in the world at basketball?
And yet you can't even microwave oatmeal, she seemed to imply. Like everyone else, our four kids have been watching the Olympics with growing fascination. After much nagging, I'd spent an afternoon driving around town trying, without success, to buy a volleyball net. We spent an evening in the driveway trying, again, without success, to corner kick a beach ball into the basketball hoop. It seemed like an Olympian pursuit, difficult, random, slightly ridiculous. Our five-year-old got so into synchronized diving that she was left bereft by the arrival of its perverse cousin, non-synchronized diving.
Why is there only one person up there?
She asked with mounting horror. But the kids' Olympic spirit was most evident when they were racing down the upstairs hallway, or racing scooters down the driveway, or fighting to be first in the car. Their usual taunts of,
I won, you lost.
Replaced by Olympian taunts of,
I won gold, you won silver.
Where's your gold medal?
Our five-year-old daughter asked her mother after one of these races.
In a bank.
She replied, and then, after a pause,
at least, I think it is.
The kids had never seen her gold medal. I'd never seen her gold medal. And my wife, Rebecca Lobo, hadn't seen her own gold medal in 16 years, since a few days after she'd won it in Atlanta. Now she wondered if it really was still in that safe deposit box for which she hadn't seen a bill in ages. What if the bank lost her forwarding address and auctioned off the box, perhaps to one of those guys on Storage Wars? I pictured Barry Weiss holding it in those skeleton glove hands of his.
Can we see your gold medal?
Our seven-year-old asked. 11 seconds later, we were in the van. In the cold silence of the bank lobby, a manager appeared with countless keys. She unlocked one exterior door and then the kind of shiny steel door seen in heist movies. She stepped inside that metal box and withdrew a smaller metal box, which my wife unlocked to reveal a third box. This one wood, like a small humidor, with the Atlanta 1996 logo on the top. For the first time since she was 22, she opened it. Slowly, as if revealing an engagement ring, she raised the metal to her nose and said,
I wonder if it still smells like beer.
As well it might. For the medal hadn't seen daylight since she returned, slightly hungover, from the Atlanta airport, where security officials had demanded she remove it from her duffel bag so they could inspect it. Gold medals get this all the time in public. They're rubbed, grabbed, groped, and bitten, the way cashiers bit nickels in 1895. It's like being on the subway 24 hours a day, which is why it has been in solitary confinement for most of its life. I picked up the medal by its green and gold ribbon and hung it around my three-year-old's neck. He scratched at the edge where women's basketball was engraved in tiny letters, as if it were gold foil wrapping concealing a chocolate coin. The five-year-old put it on, then the seven-year-old, and finally the one-year-old, who bit into it. The raised Olympic logo, now five teething rings.
May I?
It was the bank manager who ran her fingers across the medal and said,
I've always wanted to see one.
The bank manager's boss emerged from an office and hefted the medal in her palm. A customer in work boots paused to take a gander, and then the bank teller from her window across the lobby whisper shouted,
Is it okay if I've been watching the Olympics, and I...
And suddenly there was a group of us, standing around a bank lobby, looking at this glorious beer coaster. 92.5% silver, plated in 24-karat gold, getting inexplicably misty-eyed at 1 p.m. on a Monday afternoon. Finally, the manager spoke.
I saw one of these on Pawn Stars,
she said, sending a shudder down my wife's spine. In fact, the gold and silver pawn shop in Las Vegas has two Olympic medals, both bronze. One from Atlanta, priced at $20,000, and one from Barcelona, priced at $10,000. It would be foolish to leave an Olympic gold medal around the house, especially one full of little kids. But those kids were treating it like a puppy at the pound.
Can we take it home?
The seven-year-old asked, stroking its chin and thinking of names for it. And so we did, for 2 days, where it sat on the kitchen counter receiving a small line of neighbors, children, and UPS guys. Today, we're returning it to captivity before it's forever lost in the sandbox. The gold medal, we reasoned, had spent most of its life in prison. It's a hardened criminal who gets out of the joint for a few days, then commits a petty crime to get sent back in where it's most comfortable. We know it's happy there, and we've promised to visit soon. It knows we won't, and it's probably right. But it makes the goodbye a little easier.
That's our double play of Steve Rushen's August 8th, 2012 Sports Illustrated column called Finding a Long-Forgotten Gold Medal and Getting Chills All Over Again. Many thanks to actors Rob Mattson, Amanda Balaguer, Amory Sievertson, Louise Kennedy, and Tom Berry for helping us bring that story to radio. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Once upon a time, there was a podcast. A podcast that told stories, especially for kids. This podcast gathered folktales from around the world and found amazing actors to bring them to life, including some you might recognize from movies and TV.
Dear wise old woman, you are a genius!
Yep, that's Jason Alexander from Seinfeld.
You won't believe this.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and this podcast we're talking about, it's a real thing. It's called Circle Round. And whether you're a kid, a grown-up, or young at heart, we're coming your way this fall from the WBUR iLab. Hear the first episode now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And come circle round on our website, wbur.org/circleround.
I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week on Only a Game, tennis star Maria Sharapova joins Bill Littlefield with the story of how she learned that stepping in fox droppings is good luck. But right now I'm going to talk about this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hi, Charlie.
I'm glad Bill got that assignment. Hi, Karen.
ESPN's Jemele Hill attracted the attention of the White House press secretary this week when she called President Trump a white supremacist in a tweet. I've read your story on that subject, so I'm just going to let you pick it up from there.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole event was stupid. ESPN was cowardly. This White House behaved the way this White House behaves. You know, and then just when you thought it was going to die down, it somehow makes its way to the White House podium, and the White House press secretary demands or requests or suggests that ESPN fire one of its employees. So, yes, everything is crazy now. Everything is nuts. And nothing should surprise us.
Well, reports have surfaced saying ESPN considered taking Hill off the air on Wednesday. ESPN, by the way, denies this. You call ESPN cowardly. How so?
They should have just let it go. They should have absolutely let it go. I don't care what it does to the brand. Either you're a news gathering operation or you're not. And if you're not, then you shouldn't care because it was very entertaining. And if you are, you shouldn't care because it runs contrary to the spirit of what you're supposed to be doing to make all that money that you make. So, no, I don't think hanging one of your star employees out to dry because some people yelled at you on Twitter is a great deal of corporate courage right there. No, I don't.
The Oakland Athletics, who don't have to worry about playing baseball beyond October 1st, announced this week that their home game, scheduled for April 17th, 2018, will offer free admission. Do you think they'll fill the park?
That would be I will guarantee you there's already a betting line in Vegas on that. It's a 10 o'clock at night game, which means what? It's at 1 o'clock in the morning out here. I like this idea. It's their 50th anniversary. It's, you know, we've been playing in this god-awful ballpark for 50 years now, and you've been showing up, and we won a bunch of championships and wasn't that great. This is starting to smell an awful lot like Disco Destruction Night or Free Beer Night. I hope it works out well. I will be interested to see if it does.
On Thursday night, four fans were removed from their green monster seats in Fenway Park for unfurling a banner that read, "Racism is as American as baseball." We all know that affixing banners to the green monster is not allowed, Charlie, but what about the message?
Not unless you pay for the privilege, of course. Then
of
you
course.
Can put anything you want up there. Yeah, I mean, do I agree with the message? Yes, I do. And certainly baseball was as racist as America was for an awfully long time, particularly here in Boston, I might add. You know, I think you're going to see more and more of this as the era of the current administration goes on.
Well, meanwhile, in Detroit, a Lions fan has been banned from Ford Field after posting a racist message on Snapchat. A place named after the famously racist Henry Ford isn't allowing a racist back in.
Yeah, but it's a little bit spooky that they can trace their season ticket holders'
right.
social media and attempt to police it. I mean, that strikes me as a little bit over the top, to be honest with you.
Members of the Miami Dolphins have donated money to help a Miami high school football team that was stranded in Las Vegas after Hurricane Irma get home. And this is a great story, unless the NCAA decides that they can't play in college for receiving improper benefits.
Yeah, one wonders. Although, I think when it all settles down, I think the players on the Dolphins did a great thing here. What's a team from Miami doing playing a high school football game in Las Vegas? When did this become a thing?
Good question. Stephon Marbury has announced that he's coming back to the NBA. Marbury is 40 years old and hasn't played in the league for 8 years. To quote the New York Times, he did not appear to be joking. I wonder if any NBA general managers will take him seriously.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, he's certainly become sort of a wonderfully modern kind of hippie guy. He went over and played in China. He put up a video announcing his return on Instagram that said, "Yes, it's true. An NBA comeback is coming. Love is love." Okie dokie. And his Twitter handle is I am Peace Star.
Yes.
So who the heck knows? I hope he tries. I hope he makes it for a little while, because I think the postgame interviews are going to be a lot more interesting than they were when he was here the last time.
Tim Duncan's number was retired by the Spurs about 15 minutes after he announced his retirement, Charlie. But for now, the recently retired Duncan, who comes from the Virgin Islands, has more important things on his mind. At last count, about 2.5 million other important things.
Yeah, the Virgin Islands, of course, were devastated by Hurricane Irma. They took the full brunt of it when it was still a very powerful storm. Duncan's done a great job. I mean, when it comes to hurricane relief, Tim Duncan and J.J. Watt are your two stars this fall. Apparently, his hometown got off a little easier than most of the island, but the video from both Barbuda and the Virgin Islands is just devastating, and good for Tim Duncan for responding this way.
And finally, Charlie, Bill isn't here this week, so we can make fun of soccer. Let's laugh heartily about why Marco Asensio of Real Madrid missed a game on Wednesday night.
He had a pimple. I'm not making that up. It says it right here.
It's a real thing.
It's a real thing, exactly. He had an infected pimple. Now, let's be fair.
That's tough.
It was a tough one, yeah. You know, but it was a pimple, and he missed a game, and I'm never going to stop laughing at this.
Couldn't they put that magic spray on it that they have at soccer games?
I mean, couldn't they just get someone to squeeze it? I mean, it's disgusting, but it would have gotten the guy back on the field.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us on Only a Game each week. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
On January 31st, 1968, just hours into the Tet Offensive, a 27-year-old Marine captain named Chuck Meadows received an order that sounded insane. Meadows and his company of 160 Marines were holed up in an American compound in the South Vietnamese city of Hue. They were completely surrounded by thousands of North Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers. Meadows was ordered to leave the shelter of the compound and attack an enemy-controlled citadel, a large medieval-looking fortress with tall, thick walls. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has this story about the ensuing battle to take Hue and a former NFL player who would play a critical role.
To get to the enemy-controlled citadel, Chuck Meadows and his men would have to cross a bridge about the length of 4 football fields. At the other end, the enemy waited behind a heavy machine gun. Meadows knew the attack was a bad idea. So did his commanding officer in Hue, a guy named Marcus Gravel.
But Gravel, who recognized the futility of the order, nevertheless insisted that Meadows do it because he was not equipped to basically take a stand and push back against what everyone recognized was a really bad order.
That's Mark Bowden, who's researched the Battle of Hue. So Meadows and about 100 Marines charged. The North Vietnamese soldiers waited until the Marines were halfway across the bridge. Then they opened fire. None of the Marines would make it into the enemy-controlled citadel. By the time Meadows and his men retreated to the besieged American compound, 10 Marines had been killed and 56 had been wounded. Meadows was furious about what he considered an idiotic mission.
You know, he felt, you know, where was his commanding officer? Where was somebody to stick up for him and his men. He didn't have the clout. He needed somebody who would say, this is an asinine order, and I'm not sending my men out to do that.
The Americans were back where they started, in a compound about the size of a square block, surrounded by thousands of enemy troops. 2 days later, Chuck Meadows finally received some good news. A lieutenant colonel named Ernie Cheatham was coming to help. By the time he received orders to join the besieged American troops in the city of Wei, Ernie Cheatham was 38 years old and 14 years removed from professional football. Cheatham, who died 3 years ago, would probably have been the first to admit his NFL career wasn't particularly remarkable. The Pittsburgh Steelers picked him in the 21st round of the 1951 draft. Cheatham put his NFL career on pause for 2 years to fight in the Korean War. Then he suited up at defensive tackle for the Steelers for the first two games of the 1954 season.
And then they traded him for what Ernie would say was a helmet and a water bucket to the Baltimore Colts, where he finished out the season. And later he said that it was a real shock to him that the paychecks from the NFL stopped coming when the season ended.
Cheatham figured he could make better money and have more success back in the Marine Corps. So he decided to leave football behind, or at least he tried.
Much to Ernie's chagrin, commanders at various Marine Corps bases were thrilled to have an NFL lineman on their staff because most of these Marine bases had their own football teams. So he was traded from one Marine Corps base to another in order to beef up that base's football team. He didn't like that. He didn't like being known primarily as a football player. So he asked to be transferred to Alaska, where apparently they didn't have a football team.
Cheatham got his wish. And over the next decade, he rose through the ranks and eventually was transferred from Alaska to Idaho to California. In 1967, he was sent to Vietnam and promoted to lieutenant colonel. Cheatham stood out from other American commanders. For one thing, there was his physical size.
Most Marines said that the helmet swam on their heads, but Ernie looked like he was born for it, or maybe even a little bit too big for it.
But even more important, Cheatham wasn't afraid to push back against his higher-ups, and he listened to those he outranked.
Ernie Cheatham definitely had an experience with being fairly successful at something, to have played in college and to be drafted by the NFL, even in the early 1950s, meant that you were a pretty remarkable athlete. And so I think you grow up with a sense of security in your own ability when you've had early success like that.
Of course, early success can also lead to overconfidence.
In the case of Cheatham, it didn't swell his head, speaking metaphorically here, because he had a very large head. But it did, I think, give him the self-confidence to lead with good judgment.
In the hours after the fall of the city of Wei, good judgment was lacking. American commanders outside the city refused to accept that the enemy had the strength to actually control it.
General William Westmoreland, the top commander, I think serves as a kind of stereotype or a prototype for a certain kind of command folly, and that is believing your own theory of what's happening on the battlefield so strongly that facts from people who are actually in the fight didn't even make a dent in what he believed. He continued to tell everyone, including in secret cables to President Johnson and the commanders of the Joint Chief, that there were only small pockets of enemy soldiers in Wei, when his own field commanders were telling him that that wasn't true.
Ernie Cheatham was a few miles south of the city when he got the order to join Meadows and the Americans trapped in Wei. Cheatham wouldn't be able to get to the city until the following morning, so he had an evening to strategize. Unlike Westmoreland, Cheatham was willing to acknowledge there was a lot he didn't know about the situation in Wei. As Bowden points out, he didn't know the size of the enemy, he didn't know what kind of weapons they had, he didn't know about their supply lines. But he did know one thing. The fighting would take place inside a city.
And he knew that his men and he himself had no experience fighting in an urban setting.
Up until that point, the Marines had been fighting with smaller arms in the jungle and in rice paddies. So in his final hours before joining the battle, Cheatham sought out a large trunk that the battalion carried around. It contained field manuals, and Cheatham found the ones on fighting in urban settings and attacking heavily fortified positions.
And he spent the night reading them and realizing that what he was going to need were heavier weapons than what he had. He went to the battalion armory, and there were these heavy-duty bazookas, which were World War II-era rocket launchers, which fired a big, fat 3.5-pound rocket, which made a big hole in things.
Cheatham and his weapons officer rounded up as many of these unused bazookas, anti-tank rifles, and tear gas canisters as they could find. And then they headed into Hue. By the time Cheatham arrived, the Marines in Hue had suffered about 100 total casualties and gained just a block and a half. They'd have to go about another 10 blocks to take the southern part of the city. Cheatham began putting what he'd read into practice. Instead of sending men charging into the street, he'd start by using the heavier weapons.
To essentially hammer the target building, fill it full of holes, and then pump tear gas into it. This would clear out most of the enemy before he actually sent men running across the street. And instead of going through doors, you blew holes in the walls and sent men in through those holes because the enemy would likely have set up their guns to cover the entrances. These sound like simple things, but until you're actually tasked with doing them, you probably haven't given them much thought.
Colonel Cheatham, what's the objective and what are your men about to do?
Well, I've got two companies here that are just about to clear the next two blocks up.
That's Cheatham being interviewed by CBS's John Lawrence.
What kind of fighting is it going to be?
It's house to house and from room to room.
Nope. Kind of inch by inch.
That's exactly what it is.
Cheatham's tactics worked very well right from the beginning. It was still terrible fighting, block to block. But, you know, the Marines began achieving rapid success, and they were not losing men at quite the rate that they were.
After about 4 days, the Americans had taken the southern half of Hue.
That was Ernie Cheatham's accomplishment.
And by the end of February, the NVA and Viet Cong had been pushed from the citadel and the entire city. But while Cheatham's tactics were effective, they came at a terrible cost. Thousands of Vietnamese civilians had been trapped in Hue when the battle began. Many dug bunkers under their homes.
And that provided a certain degree of safety until someone like Ernie Cheatham came along and started raining, you know, heavy rockets on that position.
It's impossible to get an exact number, but Bowden estimates somewhere between 5,000 to 8,000 civilians died in Hue. Back in the U.S., as the battle dragged on for weeks, attitudes about the war and the American commanders started to change.
The idea that this was somehow going to be easy and that American forces were in complete control was shattered.
CBS's Walter Cronkite began to distrust the government's account of the Tet Offensive and decided to visit Vietnam himself. He stopped in Hue during the second week of the battle. Cronkite had been told by General Westmoreland that the fighting in Hue was over. After 2 days in the city, Cronkite could see that wasn't the case. He left the city in a military chopper filled with body bags and with material for a special report on the war.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
I don't think that America's perception of the war ever really recovered from the Battle of Hue and from the Tet Offensive. It was at that point that the anti-war movement really took off.
Ernie Cheatham returned to the U.S. that July. He retired a lieutenant general in 1988, and he remains the highest-ranking military official to have played in the NFL.
I think he stands in sort of stark contrast to the higher-level commanders in Vietnam. He knew what he didn't know, and he was determined to find out what he needed to know in order to be successful. And I think those are lessons that we can apply to just about any task any of us has ever given.
That's Mark Bowden speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Bowden writes more about Ernie Cheatham and the Battle of Hue in his book, Hue 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler, Gary Wallach, and me, with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.